Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Friday, June 19th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. Christine Rosen is off today with me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today, the author of the Commentary July-August cover story, America Run Riot, Wilfred Riley, Associate Professor of Political Science at Kentucky State University. Hey, Will, how are you?
Pretty good. Kind of tired, but glad to be here.
Great. Well, your cover story is, as has become your wont as a player and intellectual describing American politics and American society, you are a myth buster. You are a hoax revealer. First piece that you wrote for Commentary was an adaptation of your book, Hate Crime Hoaxes and Why They Happen. And now you've written America Run Riot, which is an effort to sort of correct the record about police violence and the aftermath of the George Floyd killing. So the piece is just out on commentarymagazine.com. I urge everybody within earshot to read it. So let me just ask, it's a very complicated piece, so there's no, you know, there's no log line, there's no, you know, sound bite to really describe it, but you are trying to say, let us just take a look at the evidence in front of our faces and not be distracted by the passions of the moment if we can do so, right?
Yeah, one of the focuses of my writing is taking kind of that quantitative background from my PhD process and trying to take a look at some of the things people talk about in society. White privilege was an example in one of my books, and see whether they actually make sense, whether they're empirically real. So the Floyd piece, which I enjoyed writing for you guys, I mean, that touches on a lot of things, like the impact of rioting on small minority-owned businesses. But part of it is simply looking at the claims that the Black Lives Matter movement, broadly defined, makes. And I mean, one of those is that there's a very large amount of hostile interaction between African Americans, especially young men, and the police. I believe it was Chernobico went on Fox News about 2 years back and said that every 28 hours, a young Black man, I believe he said an unarmed Black individual, is murdered by the police. And that's simply not accurate. There are other estimates from the BLM camp. This number goes into the thousands. There's a book by attorney Benjamin Crump, who is the Trayvon Martin family attorney, called Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People, arguing that there's a Holocaust-style targeting of African-Americans in the USA. And the numbers just don't bear out these extreme claims. I mean, if you go to the Washington Post police shootings database, some numerical issues there from time to time, but probably the gold standard. I mean, in the most recent year on record, the total number of unarmed Black people killed by the police was 15. That's up from 9, which is what that was originally listed as. The total number of unarmed people overall, and as usual, this figure is about 75% white and Hispanic. But total number of unarmed people killed by American LEOs combined was a bit under 60.
LEO being law enforcement.
Yeah, law enforcement officer. Yeah. Cops, basically.
So you said 60.
60 total. Right. Yeah, unarmed.
In 2019.
Yeah, that's correct.
In a nation of 330 million people and where there are 688,000 law enforcement officers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That to me was the most striking thing about unpacking Black Lives Matter. I mean, I'm a Black man by background, also of, you know, Irish and Plains Indian descent, but I identify as a Black guy. I assumed there'd be something to the movement. I mean, just as there exists sexism, just as there exists anti-Semitism, and racism is obviously real. But if you look at their numbers, if you look at that factual foundation, I mean, that's just not there. The total number of people armed or unarmed, all races. This includes people with guns attacking the officer. This includes a guy who drove over a cop with an SUV. Total number of people shot by police in 2019, period, is 1,002. Only 229 of those individuals were identified as African Americans. And again, that's almost directly proportional. I mean, the United States of America is nearly 15% Black, and there is a higher crime rate at least if you're talking about violent crimes, police encounter crimes in Black communities. So there doesn't necessarily, I see the cat in the background, there doesn't necessarily seem to be any substantial overrepresentation there at all. Now, there are people like Roland Fryer, great scholar, who will say, if you look at the lower levels of interaction, their cops are 10, 15% more likely to be rude to African-Americans. I don't know if there's an adjustment made there for class or how the encounter goes or whatnot, but still, I mean, that's not good. But even in that paper, when he ran his full regressions and unpacked police interactions, when it came to more serious things, beating, shooting, certainly when it came to shooting with everything else controlled for, white people were 24% more likely to be shot by law enforcement officers. So I don't really see a there. We don't see epidemic police violence against anyone. And that includes Black people.
So you mentioned Harvard economist Roland Fryer.
Yes.
Who was mentioned also in a piece, which is a good companion piece. A lot of this is in your book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, which you should look up. It's on Amazon. There was a piece that I think pairs reasonably well with some of the stuff that you wrote about by John McWhorter, published in Quillet, which essentially he brings up the stats that Fryer notes. And there is a case that can be made there about a racial element to police interactions, particularly interactions with minorities that involve handcuffing them, for example, or stops, which fall short of arrest-related deaths, but are nevertheless very troubling. And McWhorter notes a variety of other socioeconomic indicators, demographics, signifiers that could account for this level of interaction that appears excessive. And it's sort of odd that didn't appear in his usual perch in The Atlantic. It had to be published in a heterodox journal, Quillet. And so it seems like while there's an argument that could be made here, and it's one that doesn't discount the Black Lives Matter movement entirely, it does strike at the heart of their central claim, which is that there is some sort of, as you say, Holocaust and African Americans in this country. And why do you think that it is that they wouldn't make the argument that is more supported and is just as abhorrent?
Well, because I don't think it is just as abhorrent. I mean, that's very well phrased in terms of the argument there. But I mean, what Black Lives Matter is saying is that and of course, Black Lives Matter is a collection of diffuse groups. I mean, many of which are focused skillfully on local issues. There's no one clearinghouse speaking with a single combined voice. But when you look at the primary spokesman for Black Lives Matter in the media, going back to Sean King, their claim has been that there is epidemic nearly on par with historical reality, racism in the United States. And I don't think the argument African-Americans are 10% more likely to be handcuffed, cops need to tone it down a bit, necessarily is significant enough to make that point. I mean, that there's no way to get a book called Legalized Genocide out of that, is there? I mean, so I'm genuinely interested in these questions. What the effect of racism is on the life of the average working or middle-class minority citizen. Probably because I am myself a minority citizen and I teach at a historically Black college. And it's actually fairly complicated to unpack some of these questions. I mean, so first of all, the main point that I would make about the Fryer piece is that when you get into extreme police violence, whites were more likely to be the targets. Just scrolling through the data on a site like www.killedbypolice.net or in the WAPO database, it becomes fairly apparent that the people most likely to be shot by cops are poor whites and recent Latino immigrants. If you look at the counties where there's a significant amount of police violence, I mean, that pattern's pretty telling. So you don't want to be glib about this at all, but I mean, you could ask the question, would you prefer to run a 15% enhanced risk of being handcuffed or of being shot? I don't think Fryer's paper necessarily supports the contention that Blacks in particular are abusively targeted, at least as you get up into, higher incidences of police misconduct. Even with the lower stuff, I wouldn't discount that might occur. I mean, as a young man, especially as a minority man, I mean, you could have some pretty negative encounters with the police. I have. But to really adjust, to really see whether that's the case across all races, you'd have to adjust for socioeconomic variables. You'd have to adjust for behavior, which is almost a taboo thing to say, but do all people interact with police in the same way? Is there more fear or more hostility in Black communities? I mean, that's somewhat plausible. What we do see is that there are some fairly small gaps. And for the moment, I'm comfortable, as I think you guys are, attributing those to perhaps some level of bigotry. But those don't really make the BLM case, which is that America requires system-wide change. And this is an important point. I mean, if the argument was body cameras for everyone, or we need to take qualified immunity out of police contracts, which I think most people on the center right would support. In fact, I think that public sector unions in general need to be reined in on a couple of metrics. But if that were the argument, there'd be considerable consensus. I mean, instead, you're seeing arguments like, well, we need to abolish the police. And that's not an exaggeration. I mean, there was a New York Times lead editorial that just said, yes, what we mean is abolish the police. I don't think that the lower end Friar data could necessarily support that. So you see a focus on, you know, higher end things that may or may not be real.
Well, you know, here's what's interesting to me. As you say, Will, an accurate reading of all the relevant data doesn't exist in the arguments that are now in the public. Yet, that data are reflected in sort of the solutions, in the sense that all people are really talking about ultimately here are broad measures to rein in police aggressiveness, right? I mean, so people are talking about banning chokeholds and things of that nature. I think that is, in a sense, and by the way, Black Lives Matter allies are frustrated by those suggestions because they are broad and not geared towards racial interactions.
Yes.
But I think the fact that those responses and those suggested solutions, policy solutions, are broad is a reflection of the fact that you can't quite get around the fact that the data aren't there as the Black Lives Matter would suggest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's roughly accurate. So again, this is one of those things that in a less speech-constrained era, I don't think anyone would feel the need to say, but obviously we all oppose actual active racism, I'm sure. We all oppose police brutality, dirty cops. And there are a number of things that could be done to improve policing. I mean, just starting from, you know, the biggest imaginable, I would probably legalize drugs if I were in a king of the world position, which would remove virtually all of those crimes for which you do see a significant racial disparity in arrests. It's possible to exercise a level of bias when it comes to rounding up kids smoking weed that really doesn't exist when it comes to, say, murder, sexual assault. I mean, if a murder victim was killed by Italian-American mobsters, it is not going to be feasible for the police to pursue a Black guy as the murderer. So, I mean, there are things that could be done to eliminate potential bias at its source at the level of, you know, rewriting legal codes. But more realistically, in the modern climate, I mean, again, I don't have a problem with banning chokeholds, although I'm not in the DM, the decision maker chair there. I think most people would favor body cameras for the unbelievably large, something like 40% of departments that still don't have them, or for securing funding to provide that resource. Again, qualified immunity is an issue. You can talk about militarized policing. Are there certain vehicles that should be kept in the garage, essentially, unless there's a SWAT mission? But you're absolutely right that a lot of this doesn't get to the core claims of specifically BLM because it's not racialized whatsoever. And there's a very simple reason for that. And that reason is that 75% of the people killed, shot by police are Hispanics or they're working income whites. They're not African American. So if you want to rein in police behavior, you are by definition going to have to rein in those things that actually kill people. And there's no police behavior that I can think of that targets only African Americans.
No, I'll give you an example of this. So, you know, I think one of the earliest and most successful efforts at reining in what was seen to be excessive police hostile or unpleasant interactions with civilians was the war on stop and frisk in New York City, right? So, and you know, the stop and frisk, its purpose was to get guns off the street. That when they stop and frisk, they're looking for weapons, knives and guns. And since guns are largely illegal, or almost entirely illegal in New York City and New York State. The presumption would be if you find someone with a gun, they don't have it, they don't have a license, and so they are committing a crime. As time went on, and the crime drop was so precipitous, it was of necessity that stop and frisk was a less successful policy in aggregate, right? In other words, more stops, fewer seizures of guns, because they had got all the low-hanging fruit over the previous years. And so if what you wanted was numbers, if you were the NYPD and you wanted numbers of arrests and all that, you actually had to increase the number of these interactions simply to get, you know, enough perps, you know, into the system. And so you could make an argument. I mean, I'm less sympathetic to this, but just fleshing it out, you can make an argument that this was a risk reward or opportunity cost problem, that the virtue of making these busts was not worth the cost in the hostile, you know, in sort of community mood, right? But here's the weird part about it. So New York is way more Hispanic than it is Black. And so you would never know that from the ideological assault on stop and frisk. But almost certainly it was the case that the majority of people who were stopped and frisked in New York City, since these numbers are not done, you know, by race, if you're talking about seeing a group of kids on a corner and a cop comes over and says, okay, you know, hands on the wall, and then, you know, does the frisk, were Hispanic and not Black. They were Dominican, they were Puerto Rican, they were Haitian, they were all kinds of things. They weren't, well, Haitians are Black, but you know, they were, yeah, but they were more likely to be Hispanic or Latino than they were Black. And yet this became a thing about how the police department was racist and had to be reined in from its racist behavior. So that's another element of the way in which, if you want to reform policing, most of the benefit in terms of the lessening of police aggression is actually going to be for whites and Hispanics, and not for African Americans, because of the nature of the population of the country, which is 74% white, 15% Black, and 12% Hispanic, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's what you'd find nationally speaking, frankly. I mean, I'm in Frankfort, which is the capital of Kentucky, and we're maybe an hour from Appalachia, pretty close to the larger cities in the state, Lexington, Louisville. And I mean, the worst neighborhood in Frankfort, a home street, is almost exclusively white. I would bet that the large majority of people in at least Lexington, possibly Louisville, that are stopped, frisked, patted down by the police would be Appalachian working poor whites. And that is very typical in a lot of states. I mean, West Virginia, some of the coastal states as you move down, South Carolina, perhaps. I mean, I'd have to go state by state, but this is never mentioned. These are often described as African-American problems. And as you said, that's not the reality. I mean, in New York, that actually is correct. Empirically, the majority of people stopped and frisked in most years were Hispanic. Why isn't that discussed? I think you have to look at different community attitudes toward the police and toward crime. But the background issue when you get into stop and frisk, something that a lot of people don't seem to understand, I don't mean to be glib about this, but the police are not in minority neighborhoods just because they dislike Black people or to piss off liberals. I mean, really going back to Giuliani and Breton in 1994, and you guys pioneered this in New York. We did it quite well in Chicago as well. But you're talking about cop stat policing, where you basically have an Excel or Stata breakdown of the crime that's going on in your city. And you're going to very specifically flood high crime neighborhoods with patrolmen, with officers up through detective level. And you're going to look for minor offenses. This is sometimes referred to as broken windows policing, stop and frisk policing. But to check people to see whether or not they're criminals and to get more severe, to get people off the street for more severe offenses. So you're going to pat people down and look for guns. As part of that process, if you find one, you're obviously going to quote unquote run somebody for warrants. You're going to look for knives and other weaponry. Sometimes you're going to pat people down for drugs. But all that's done in response to pre-existing high crime in a neighborhood. And it has had an extraordinarily successful effect on crime rates.
So you could be forgiven. I mean, the reformation of police practices preoccupies us, preoccupies policymakers, because it's something that you can actually do. You could be forgiven for thinking that the activist class would view police reforms actually as a little beside the point. And you kind of get to this around the edges in your piece for a commentary, particularly in a rather astute anecdote in which you observe that, you know, particularly in Minneapolis, where you had these several blocks that were torched by demonstrators, more than a handful of those who were participating in those demonstrations and violent demonstrations were white themselves, burning minority-owned businesses while carrying the ironically carrying signs that say Black Lives Matter. And what we've seen really in the wake of these violent protests, particularly in bourgeois publications like the New York Times, with a white, affluent, educated readership, defenses of violent action like this, defenses of looting as righteous expressions of the unheard masses. And that resonates with a particular group, but it might not necessarily resonate with the people who are most affected by this behavior on the ground. So are police reforms just sort of a red herring?
Well, I think that that's a fascinating and multi-layered question.
I appreciate my layers.
Well done. No, but I mean, but it really is interesting. Like, I was looking through a buddy's quant piece recently, and what he was arguing is that the policy positions that are often advocated by groups like Black Lives Matter don't reflect the policy preferences of actual working class African Americans or other Black groups. They reflect the policy preferences of liberal white women who are likely to donate. And I thought that was fascinating. I bet it's true when all regressions are run. If you read Heather McDonald, any of the scholars on the center right that have taken a quant look at this, that have actually polled African Americans in working class areas, one of the most consistent things you hear from them is that working class areas are under, not over policed. So, I mean, as I just said, stop and frisk policing, comp stat policing is a direct response to crime. Perhaps at the level of the individual officer on the ground, there may be some bias, but at the level of, you know, one police plaza or whatever it's called in NYC, there is no racial element to that whatsoever. You locate where criminal events are happening, whether that's a Dominican American neighborhood, Italian American neighborhood, African American neighborhood, and you send officers. And I know that over the past 25 years, neighborhoods and all those demographics have received extra officers. And that's generally fairly popular with the people in those areas. Even if you're talking about disproportionate rates of stop and frisk, by the way, you have to compare those to crime rates. Now, this is a bit of a deviation, but when people say, well, I believe in New York, it was African-American men are four times as likely, they're very similar sized populations, to be stopped by police officers than white men. New York's a city that's known for having a disproportionately affluent white population. Chicago is as well, and a disproportionately working poor Black population. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the Black violent street crime rate were four times the white violent street crime rate, although, of course, that wouldn't hold true for corporate crime. But I would bet that in very many cases, perhaps 5% effective racism on the margins, but you're going to be seeing these police stops effectively match the pattern of crime. There aren't a lot of, you know, upper middle class Manhattan matrons out there robbing people. So they're much less likely to be arrested or to be patted down by the police. But at any rate, yeah, I don't think that police reform is very popular with people, quote unquote, living in the hood, although they would certainly prefer an end to any abuses that are occurring. I think police reform is advocated by people who favor a general slate of upper middle class left wing social policies. And the reason I said there are a lot of layers to that question, yeah, the thing that actually, I mean, I'm a big city guy myself, fairly hard to offend, but that offended me, that pissed me off about the specifically Minneapolis riots, was that it wasn't scattered Caucasian demonstrators, I don't excuse rioters of any race. You had a mob that was at least 50% white when it got to Lake Street, burning down the city's traditional Black and Asian business district. So you literally had white thugs yelling Black Lives Matter and setting businesses on fire.
It's an interesting counterexample to the riots of the 1960s that destroyed the H Street corridor in Washington and other places, where the idea was that they were burning down white-owned businesses in black neighborhoods that were this was the general tenor of it. Jewish-owned, white-owned businesses that were supposedly gouging the people with unfair, you know, overly pricey groceries and goods. And so this was a kind of war against, you know, people who Al Sharpton 25 years later would call white interlopers into the area. Now, in these areas, you have an extraordinary number of minority-owned businesses. And so any justification for that is lacking. And, you know, even though the justification in the 1960s was a horrible justification, and the incredible irony, as you say, of white people, middle-class white people burning down working-class black people businesses and looting them is insane. Yeah. It's mind-boggling. Like, I don't know how you yes. get to the bottom of the ironies there. But I want to move on to the Rayshard Brooks case, because one of the interesting things in your yeah. piece is you say these encounters are complex. The encounter between the officer in Minneapolis and George Floyd may have been more complex than anybody realizes because of this bizarre detail that they were both bouncers at a club in Minneapolis at the same time. And no one's ever gotten to the bottom of, did they know each other? Was there prior hostility between them that plays a role here, which would vitiate, potentially not vitiate, but wouldn't be the racist cop killing black guy narrative that you might necessarily think it was. Maybe it is, but you know, complexity is part of what happens here. And there is no more complex event than this Rayshard Brooks thing, in which 15 things happened in the space of 30 seconds. And this district attorney in Fulton County simply, you know, sort of says, oh, it's very clear, you know, he shouldn't have, he wasn't allowed to shoot him in the back. The cop should have known that the taser wasn't effective, as though like it's 11 o'clock at night and somebody's being shot at and he's supposed to go through a whole ratiocination where he understands the risks, rewards, and the regulations that should be attended upon him, right?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I mean, so again, this gets into the use of kind of modern empirical methods, qualitative and quantitative, to sort of analyze things. I mean, you're correct that the George Floyd case. Now, first of all, every time I discuss the George Floyd case, I say on the record, as someone with some legal background, I think this certainly technically qualifies as a murder, depending. I mean, there are multiple categories of murder. We don't need to get into that, but a disgusting video. I would have brought charges against all of the officers involved, and that is what occurred. No excuse for that terrible policing. But with that said, the narrative that this is a bunch of, and it's always the same narrative, right? The narrative that this is a bunch of KKK-level racist white men that killed a black man for existing is not valid even in the George Floyd case. The most obvious example of what you were talking about just now is that two of the officers on the scene were men of color. I mean, that's, again, one of those things that you're sort of supposed to not discuss, as is the fact that Floyd and Chauvin almost certainly knew one another. They'd both been bouncers at a large Minneapolis Latin-themed nightclub for, as I recall, something like 10 years. That is something that's kind of been swept into the ether. The narrative has to be maintained. But at any rate, Thao, for example, is of Hmong descent. Kung is, I believe, of Korean and Hispanic descent. And very unlikely to be a hard-edged conservative, by the way, a four-year degree in sociology from the local college. Like, this was a very diverse group of officers. There are contradictory pictures online, but I'm just going to assume Lane was Caucasian and say 50-50. But the idea that this was a group of Klansmen attacking Mr. Floyd, I mean, that's not correct. Two of these guys were non-white guys with no substantial claims of at least racial bias. Chauvin himself was in an interracial marriage, although that happened to be with someone of Asian American rather than African American heritage, but his wife was from the Philippines. So just saying, well, all these people are bigots and we haven't made any moves past bigotry, that doesn't even seem to even describe that case. But that case was such an abuse of police power that I think we can say, well, it's good that those four men are facing charges. It doesn't matter what race they were. The Rayshard Brooks case, though, is an even more extreme example of sort of total narrative collapse. I viewed the tape. I wasn't there at the time, so I'm not going to give an opinion on whether this is police abuse, but that's a very different situation. And it says, at the very least, this is something that probably would not have even been considered as the basis for a criminal charge for a cop of any race 10 years ago. I mean, what happened in the Rayshard Brooks case is that a guy passed out intoxicated, as I understand, in the drive-thru of a busy Wendy's. I would assume their cars backed up behind him for a substantial distance. Officers arrive on the scene. They're absolutely professional. The opening portion of the Brooks video is them talking to him for 40 minutes. Buddy, you're going to have to take a breathalyzer. No, we can't let you walk home. When they attempt to put the cuffs on Brooks, I think it's fair to say Brooks freaks out. And we now know the reason for that. I'm bringing this up because it's relevant here, is that he had an extensive violent criminal history and he would have popped probation and gone back to prison had he been arrested. So Brooks, as he becomes aware of this, fights the cops. They know how to fight, but he clearly does as well. He beats up both of them, basically, grabs a taser from one of the officers. This guy suffered a concussion during the fight and runs away with the stolen police strength taser in his hand. When a cop chases him, he turns around and fires the taser at him. This is in the longer cut of the video. You see he misses his head and his eyes by maybe a foot, foot and a half. And the police officer, who's in this situation where they're both basically in a stance 5 feet from each other, fires at Mr. Brooks and shoots him. Yeah, you never want anyone to die. But comparing that to something like the George Floyd killing is extraordinarily bizarre. You can debate whether or not you should shoot a primary weapon at someone armed with a secondary weapon. I actually have a sideline in pistol instruction. I mean, it's a tough call to make, let's say. But presenting this as sort of an individual being martyred for being black borders on the obscene. I mean, this is...
Right, and then you have... I mean, you couldn't even call it a rush to judgment. The police chief resigns... the mayor says the city is in crisis, and then a district attorney who is losing in a very close battle in a Democratic primary race and has all kinds of ethics charges being levied, ethics and personal peccadillo charges levied against him, goes for this set of charges. Before the investigation is completed by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. So, you know, at the very least, you have the moral panic of the moment doing exactly what is not supposed to happen under our legal system, which is a rush to judgment and a presumption of guilt, which is, I think, pretty much what that press conference with the district attorney really sounded like. I mean, it was basically not just that he was charging him or, you know, looking to charge him, but it was kind of like the summation of the prosecution at a trial. Yep. He did this. He did this for 2 minutes. He did that for 3 minutes. They, you know, clearly he kicked him, which is the opposite of true. Yep. Like, it's not clear. It's not clear they kicked him. It's not clear they were standing on him. None of that is clear from the same evidence that we can see, right? So all I want to bring up is these are complex incidents, and the passion of the moment is to reduce them into a moral pageant in which a mustache-twirling villain who represents the mustache-twirling villainy of America is... abusing and killing somebody who at the very least shouldn't be dead, right? That's, at the most is a totally innocent martyr.
Well, so here's something that, I mean, we're beating up on the myths of the BLM movement pretty substantially here. And something that I think they do have a point on and I find discomforting is the issue of police culture and police unions in particular. The episode that sparked all of this, the arrest-related death of George Floyd. As you say, the racial makeup of the attending officers in that event doesn't suggest, you know, a group of Klansmen, but it does suggest a level of tribalism within the culture of police that at least even if they found those 8 minutes, 45, whatever seconds discomforting to them, they didn't act on it for whatever inducements, incentives led them to remain tacit in that moment, I think is pretty compelling. And what happened in Atlanta the night after this officer was charged, apparently a whole lot of officers didn't show up.
Yep.
Demonstrated, you know, we have the power to affect the situation as well. If they perceive themselves to be beset by some form of institutional oppression, it's one that you can understand. But nevertheless, if these charges won't stick, if he's been overcharged and they can't prove that in a court, then to demonstrate that sort of that level of frustration with the system is a vote of no confidence in the system, akin to anything we've seen in the streets over the last 2 months. I find that extremely discomforting, and an abdication of their responsibilities in their jobs. Now, I guess that you can justify that, but you can also justify the sense of oppression that is felt among rioters and looters. We've seen it a lot, and it's rather not so especially compelling. So I wouldn't find the whatever justification these officers made to walk off the job as compelling. It is a vote of no confidence in the system.
That's an interesting moral statement. I mean, I try to be moral in my day-to-day personal and business life. I mean, I think morally that is in fact valid. I mean, if we're going to frankly pretend, if you look at any serious anthropological study, that morals are ultimate and shared among people, I do think that the baseline has to be people have to obey the damn law. I myself am not civilized enough, and I mean this to some extent in a positive sense, to go much further than that. I'm not going to obey the law while you cannot, you know? So, I mean, someone asked me, I do a lot of African-American media, and someone asked me, well, what do you think of looters? And I said, well, they should go to prison because they broke the law, or jail. And someone asked me, what do you think of bad cops? And I said, well, I think they should go to prison or jail because they broke the law. I mean, George Floyd's murderers, they prison or jail because they broke the law. I mean, I'm very consistent about this. So I tend to agree with you. I think that I don't feel so. First of all, when you say you can understand the feeling of oppression that the rioters had, I don't see that the rioters had any justifiable feeling of oppression. I mean, I'm an upper middle class black dude myself, and it's not all that brutal compared to a lot of countries I've been to. And half the rioters were white. I mean, I don't see any excuse for them whatsoever.
No, to clarify, it's a rationalization, one that I don't find compelling. Oh, similarly. Oh.
By the way, the Wendy's that Richard Brooks was at was black owned and was set on fire by two white women.
Two white women, yes. No, but I mean, and Noah, I don't entirely agree with your point, but I think morally it's absolutely valid. Like, yeah. In a coherent system where everyone was handling their roles as they should be handled, yeah, the police chief probably has a duty to discipline or even fire those officers that, you know, called in sick and caused the loss of a precinct. So again, I guess I don't really disagree. I mean, the standard for me would be that at every level, the rules have to be enforced. Now, I'm a little more sympathetic to these officers, to be frank, because we've seen the widespread ignoring of the rules throughout this entire process. I mean, in a large number of cities, including, I believe, Baltimore, Atlanta, major world-class regional capitals, people that were arrested for protesting and even rioting were then let go. I mean, there were no bail policies under coronavirus. There were cities that said specifically it would be immoral to arrest them. So if the
people, as they are arresting and charging and prosecuting people who are protesting against lockdown orders.
Yeah. And as they're doing all this other BS, I mean, in New York, didn't they weld the gates of the largest park in one of the Jewish communities shut because there were kids playing in it?
Yeah.
I mean,
expert enforcement of lockdown orders based on class and race in this city has been well documented. And the complaints among people who are in poorer or minority dominated neighborhoods that they were being over policed as opposed to places like Chelsea Piers where they let everybody go free. The city's response was to say, okay, well, we're just going to enforce Chelsea Piers.
But by the way, Noah, one of the reasons I think your point is morally apposite, but is a slightly off to the side is that police officers are working men who they are not in the military and they are not, you know, they haven't been impressed into service in the draft. They can take a day off, and they can take a day off if they're that you can make an argument that it's probably a pretty good idea for somebody who is in emotional extremis over something like the feeling that they're being, that people are out to get them, that maybe it's a good idea for them to cool off and take a day off. Now, that doesn't mean that they should, if they're on duty and they refuse to respond to calls and things like that, that's a problem. That's a disciplinary problem for the department that it would need to deal with. But
I mean, if it is a display of civil disobedience in response to a presumption of institutional oppression,
but it's not. You see,
you have to claim it.
You'd also have to claim it. They're not saying we are refusing to come to work because you're being unfair. They're just not going to work.
They have to be sick.
May be bad. I'm saying that may be bad, but you know it is. They have negotiated contracts that apply, you know, that offer them personal days and things like that. So, and personal days are days you can take where you don't have to give a reason.
Well,
right.
I'm not
defending it as a method, but they're not AWOL. Like they're not in the military and they're not like refusing to go onto the battlefield. It's not the same thing. But
well, this also gets into, again, like, as I said, ultimate morals in, you know, in my relate in anthropology, you know, a cousin discipline to my own. There seem to be about 8 or 9 human universals like don't eat people. And beyond that, we to some extent make up morals at the level of code writing, developing law. And I absolutely agree. I don't want to just repeat myself here. I absolutely agree. People should follow the law. But there's also kind of a gray area of plausible deniability when you get into this sort of thing, as John just pointed out. I mean, so yes, what I guess I'd say about these officers is, well, you got to prove it if you're the mayor. I mean, if a police officer is stupid, for want of a better word, enough to say, I am very upset by the current police chief's policies and I am protesting by illegally not coming to work, that guy should absolutely be fired. He openly did an immoral thing and admitted it. But
I just want to move off this for the last couple of minutes because something else that you have been involved in, which is the 1776 project, which is an answer to the 1619 project. We have gone from protests against a video that showed a cop kneeling on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 48 seconds. 3 weeks later or whatever, 4 weeks later, to people in Portland pulling down a statue of George Washington last night as though it were a statue of Saddam Hussein. And there seems to be a through line here, right? These are connected events somehow. I just think maybe you have some words of wisdom on this and how they have been connected and why that is so dangerous.
Okay, I do, actually. I think that what connects many of the, and you referred to the destruction of the George Washington statues, correct? There's a blink out on my earbuds for a second.
Yes, yeah.
All right. I think what connects a great deal of this, whether you're talking about the rioting in the streets, whether you're talking about the demands for massive reconstruction, if you will, of American policing or American legal codes. If you're talking about the destruction of statutes, not of Confederate enemy generals, but of the very founders of the country, the underlying narrative behind a lot of this is what, when I speak, I sometimes call the 1619 narrative, which is that America is an existentially evil society. We were founded on slavery and the destruction of Native Americans. Our founding ideals were never sincere. Most American wealth comes from the oppression of others. And essentially, we should turn over the keys to the country to a better, newer, braver, more multicolored generation that deserves it. And a great deal of this happens to be nonsensical. It is definitely true that during the unfortunate period of history when most nations were formed on conquest and most nations had slaves, we engaged in conquest and we had slaves. But there also is a shining element to the American ideal. I mean, we were the first large modern democracy to a very real extent, unless you want to argue the Venetian Republic. We are one of the few societies around the world that has ever truly opened her borders to immigrants from virtually everywhere, which is how we happen to have the groups we've been discussing in this conversation, Irish Americans, Italian Americans, West Indian Black Americans, Jewish Americans, so on down the line. And empirically, many of the claims that are made by advocates of the 1619 position are simply false. Slavery obviously enriched individual flint-hearted plantation owners, but if you look at any accurate economic census of the United States, the antebellum South was a feudal backwater, about on par with the regions of Russia that also relied on serf agriculture. Since slavery was abolished in 1865, the American economy has grown something like 11,000%. I'd have to change my actual figures. We didn't, for that matter, have slavery for 400 years. The USA began in 1776. We abolished the peculiar institution in 1865. So I think that we as a country need to understand the stains of our past while also understanding the glories of the past and moving forward toward the future. This is all a bit political speech-makey, but it also happens to be real. I mean, it's important to have a warts and all view of your own society. It's idiotic to have an all warts view of your own society and a warts-free view of competitors. Like the societies that are often cited as positive alternatives, China, Germany. I certainly think there's some things that could be found in their past on par with anything we've done.
So, yeah, so I'd like to introduce briefly to this conversation, the Hannah Nicole Jones has a tweet today. It is June 19th, Juneteenth. She notes that today, happy Emancipation
Hannah Nicole
Day.
Jones, we should say, is the sort of the progenitor of the 1619 project.
Right, and go ahead. Pulitzer Prize winner as a result of it. Happy Emancipation Day, she writes. It is not Emancipation Day. Just a few facts. The U.S. was third to last in the Americas to abolish slavery. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it is certainly true that most of the Western European nations that were sovereign over just about all of the Western Hemisphere at that time did abolish slavery earlier than that, but you're attributing that to Western European political thought. And the Emancipation Proclamation came about partly because enslaved people were self-liberating by the thousands. Don't let them tell you we just waited to be free. This is the historical narrative that obtains now in just about all of effete liberal thought. It is really self-destructive.
Right. So if you go to
and that, irrational and not yeah. true.
So if you go to that argument, so this was the point. So first, the Confederate statues and the Confederate flag were, you know, there was a serious and sustained discussion about whether or not there should be tributes to the Confederacy, which I think there shouldn't be, for obvious reasons, including the fact that the Confederacy was an ignoble effort to destroy the United States, nonetheless. So, you know, so that happened. And now, and then if you move on, there is this argument, well, Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder and George Washington was a slaveholder. And therefore, because they were slaveholders, we should not honor them. Well, that's a disgraceful thing to think, I think, but, you know, but it's not dismissible off the, you know, like at root, right? You can't just simply, okay, but what Nicole Hannah Jones does in that tweet is she's going after Lincoln now. See, she's right. Going after Lincoln. The Emancipation Proclamation was nonsense. We were liberating ourselves, and this was just some, you know, face-saving effort to pretend that, you know, Lincoln did not wage the war to end slavery
If I can comment on that, yeah. I mean, obviously there was a great deal of heroic Black resistance to slavery.
Of course.
As there's been heroic resistance around the world by slaves of all colors to slavery. But there's been only, as I understand, one successful slave revolt in history that produced the nation of Haiti. Even Spartacus failed and was crucified by the roadside. The reason that slavery ended in the United States is that the Union Army, composed of immigrants from all around the world, free Blacks, Quakers, citizens of every variety, conquered the South and killed one in four adult fighting men in the region. That's what freed the slaves. And I mean, you could note that if there was a bill due for slavery, the USA's very arguably paid it in blood. 610,000 people died during the Civil War. I mean, the population of the country at the time was, as I understand, under 100 million. Nine slaves were freed for every Union soldier that died, I believe would be the figure. So that is what ended slavery. And as we move forward toward a broader analysis of these questions, I agree with you guys. No sympathy whatsoever as a Black man for the Confederacy. I mean, in a sentence, the Confederates were racist traitors that lost. That's about it. But when you look at some of these questions, the reason that we shouldn't have statues of Confederate generals in the center of town squares is that they were the leaders of the other side. Right. When you get into these deeper questions, like should we ever honor anyone who fought in a war of conquest or ever honor anyone who owned a slave? If we didn't, given what human history used to be, we couldn't have statues of anyone, including the great Native American chiefs, for example. So it's very important. This is one of the oldest cliches in an Ethics 102 class, but it's very important to judge people, if, again, we're going to use moral standards at all, by the standards of their time. 100 years from now, it would be absolutely ridiculous for people to tear down a statue of Bill Clinton or George W. Bush because he ate factory farmed meat. I believe that is something that will be seen as an absolute atrocity down the road. That we took these animals with G-factor IQs of 40 or 50 pigs, much less chimps. We walled them up in these storehouses and abused them. But as of right now, unfortunately, that is a characteristic of society that almost everyone benefits from. I don't think that we can judge each individual in our society as flawed because of that, or because of our ideas about destroying the environment, so on.
Okay, so Wilfred Riley, thank you so much for joining us today. Please, everybody, read Will's piece, America Run Riot, at commentarymagazine.com. Go to Amazon, buy his book, Hate Crime Hoaxes, buy his book, Taboo. I hope he'll join us again, and we certainly hope to have him back on our pages for many years to come. So thanks a lot for Noah, Abe, and the absent Christine Rosen. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.